Well, today I'm going to tell you a small part of the most exciting story that it's been my privilege to witness during my career in physics. It's a story with a lot of heroes, many of whom are sitting here in this room. Since I'm only going to talk about a small part of it, rather than apportioning credit as I go along and missing a lot of people whose work I won't talk about, let me read out a few important names. Sen, Duff, Hull, Townsend, Witten, Strominger, Schwartz, Bafa, Harvey, Douglas, Schenker, Aspinwall, Polchinski, Morrison, Seiberg, Susskind, Maldacena, Oguri. The list goes on for quite a while. A lot of people have contributed. I think we also have to give a vote of thanks to some old warriors from a previous story that many of us string theorists ignored for a long time, the story of 11-dimensional supergravity. Names like DeWitt, Nicolai, Ferrara, Kremer, Julia, Friedman, Deser, Zumino, and Neuenheisen. And if your name wasn't mentioned, you can see me after class. So a few years ago, if I had been giving a talk like this to a general audience on string theory, I would have talked about the five consistent string theories that we knew about. These were described as perturbation theories. We didn't really have a theory. What we had was the analog of Feynman diagrams. Feynman diagrams were very pretty. They looked like Riemann surfaces. I can't draw, so you'll have to forgive the pictures here. The computation of the Feynman diagrams was done by evaluating certain two-dimensional conformally invariant field theories on these Riemann surfaces of various genera. The genus expansion, the genus of the Riemann surface, was telling us what order of perturbation theory we were in. So the string theories, in a language that is convenient for characterizing them today, could best be described by telling you what space-time quantum numbers, what symmetries these strings carried and how they carried them. So there were the 2A and 2B string theories. Of course, all of these string theories had some number of compact dimensions, and they had Poincaré invariants in those non-compact dimensions. These were flat Lorentz invariant dimensions. And then in addition, they had various other kinds of symmetries. So the 2A and 2B supersymmetries had two kinds of supersymmetry living on their world sheets. The two kinds of supersymmetry charges traveled in opposite direction along the string. And the difference between 2A and 2B was that these strings lived in a 10-dimensional space-time. In 10 dimensions, fermions, and therefore supersymmetries, come in two handednesses, two chiralities. And in the 2B theory, both of these supersymmetry currents on the world sheet had the same chirality. In the 2A theory, they had opposite chirality. Then there was something called the heterotic string. There were two flavors of that, the SO32 and the E8 cross E8 heterotic strings. And these carried supersymmetry currents, but only running in one direction. And then, in addition, they carried currents which coupled to gauge fields, which ran in the other direction. And these JA currents had to do with gauge group, which in 10 dimensions was either SO32 or E8 cross E8, and there were no other consistent heterotic string theories. And finally, there was the type 1 string theory. It was what's called an open string theory. All of these were closed string theories. The strings didn't have any ends. In the type 1 theory, the strings did have an end. Since the strings had an end, you had to put boundary conditions on the end, and the correct boundary conditions for the fields were Neumann. As a consequence of those boundary conditions, you can't have currents that run only in one direction because things bounce off the end. And so these theories had only one kind of supersymmetry charge. It was sort of a linear combination, a standing wave of left combination of left and right moving waves. So they sort of had half as much supersymmetry as these theories, but the same amount as the heterotic theories. This theory also had a gauge group, which happened to be SO32 as well. And that gauge group, unlike these here, which were carried by the body of the string, which were currents that flowed along the string, the gauge quantum numbers were carried in the open string theory only by the ends of the string. So as I said, we had these five theories. You can now count what the five are. They all had sensible quantum mechanical perturbation expansions. They were all supersymmetric. They all included gravity automatically. That's one of the beauties of string theory. In ordinary quantum field theory, gravity doesn't make any sense in the quantum theory. We can't give a consistent quantum theory. But in string theory, it comes out automatically, and it's forced on you.
How many of them would I remember the way it would be with T-Dole?
Indeed, yes. Right, sure. Okay, now, in actual fact, there were many more string perturbation expansions than are indicated by this list. But we thought that all of those perturbation expansions were actually continuously connected onto each other. And the basic reason was that in many cases we could identify the different, there are multiple continuous families of string perturbation expansions. And usually what we can do is we can identify the members of those families as systems in which we have taken the original string theories and turned on coherent condensates of some of the fields associated with the particle-like excitations of the string. Each vibration of the string, each internal configuration of it, each eigenstate of it is associated with a particle moving through space-time. If we think of associating quantum fields with those particles, then we can imagine turning on classical expectation values for some of those quantum fields. And we found that there was a classical equation of motion that determined which fields were allowed. It was the equation that said, modulo some technical additions, that the field theory on the string world sheet was conformally invariant. And those, when we turned on those classical backgrounds, we seemed to get most of these continuous parameters of string perturbation expansions that we knew about. So we thought of those as all being part of the same theory, just corresponding to different states of that same theory, where different consistent, expanded around different consistent classical background field solutions. Now, we even were able in this framework to make transitions, understand that one could make continuous transitions between classical backgrounds that in ordinary geometry would have been considered topologically different. So many of these perturbation expansions corresponded to strings propagating on various kinds of curved compact geometries. And the geometers would tell us, well, these two classes of geometries are in different topological classes, but we would understand how to make a continuous connection between them when thought of as parameterizing string perturbation expansions. So there was a lot of continuity, a lot of theories were connected together, and as David pointed out, in this framework, one already understood that if one, for example, compactified the 2A and 2B theories on circles, a single circle was sufficient, then one could go continuously between the 2A and the 2B circle. The 2A theory at a very large radius, when one shrank the radius to zero size, came out the other end and looked like the 2B theory on a very large radius, and so on. That was what was known as T-duality. And there was also a similar T-duality between the two different types of heterotic string. Okay. Now, sitting out somewhere else in the space of theoretical speculations, there was another theory called 11-dimensional supergravity, which most string theorists thought didn't have much to do with string theory. Why? Well, Because it was in 11 dimensions, we didn't seem to see any string theory that was in 11 dimensions. They were always in 10 dimensions. Because unlike string theory, there was no decent quantum mechanical perturbation expansion for 11-dimensional supergravity. When one tried to go beyond the classical approximation to 11-dimensional supergravity, one found that the theory didn't seem to make very much sense as a quantum theory. And finally, there was a sort of phenomenological issue that came up, namely, 11-dimensional supergravity didn't have in it, one thought at the time, any mechanism for generating chiral fermions in space-time. And we know in the real world with pretty good confidence that the real theory that describes the real world, the standard model, is chiral. There are fermions of only single-handednesses that couple to certain of the gauge fields. And so the lack of chirality of 11-dimensional supergravity and the fact that these string theories did have space-time chiral fields made us feel that these two classes of theories didn't have too much to do with each other. Nonetheless, I would like to point out that we understood from the very beginning that at the level of low-energy classical field theory, there was a connection between at least one of these string theories and the 11-dimensional supergravity. Namely, if one took 11-dimensional supergravity and compactified it on one circle and then looked at the low-energy limit that one got when taking that circle very small, one found that the effective low-energy field theory that came out looked exactly like the type 2A string theory's effective low-energy theory. We didn't see the strings, but we did see the low-energy excitations of the strings. And in particular, the all string theories, and in particular the type 2A string theory, have a field in them which is associated with the string coupling, which we usually call the dilaton field. The string coupling is e to the phi, where phi is called the dilaton field, and there are different string couplings in each of these string theories. The string coupling was originally introduced as the parameter that counted what genus of Riemann surface you were in, what order of perturbation theory you were in. But it was shown in the very earliest days of string theory that one could imagine changing that value by turning on a coherent condensate of one of the massless states of the string, turning on a classical constant background for the so-called dilaton state, which is a massless scalar particle. And when one makes this correspondence between the 11-dimensional supergravity and the type 2A string theory, one finds that the dilaton field that comes out in the 10-dimensional limit is related to the radius of that circle that one compactified the 11-dimensional supergravity on. This theory has no scalar fields in it, but once one compactifies gravity, one gets an extra parameter in the lower dimensional theory corresponding to small variations in the non-compact dimensions of the radius on which one has compactified. And that was precisely the role that the dilaton field seemed to play. However, we didn't see any way to make this connection beyond the low energy approximation. And so most string theorists just sort of ignored it. Now, another thing that comes out, a very famous old story in gravity, when you compactify gravity on a circle, as first pointed out by Kaluza and Klein, you get a gauge field in the lower dimensions, always. And if you do it on a circle, it's a U1 gauge field. And so when going from 11-dimensional supergravity to type 2A string theory, you generate a U1 gauge field. And that U1 gauge field existed in the 10-dimensional type 2A theory, and it was called the Ramond U1 gauge field. Now, I will not explain to you the origin of this peculiar terminology. Poor Pierre Ramond has had to suffer with this for much of his career, being called by his name twice. But what I will tell you is that this in the context of type 2A and type 2B string theories, is actually one of a large family of generalized gauge fields. If you think about electromagnetism, the fact that the electromagnetic field is the curl of a vector potential and there's consequently a gauge invariance under A nu goes to A nu plus D nu lambda. If you know anything about differential geometry, you can immediately see a generalization of that principle. Namely, you could imagine an antisymmetric tensor field with a whole bunch of indices being written as a generalized curl of a vector potential with a lot of indices, and then a gauge transformation. Yes, thank you, David. When I write a square bracket among some indices, I mean total anti-symmetrization of those indices. And so this is what's written in differential form notation as F equals dA, and then because of the famous identity that d squared equals zero, or that the curl of a curl vanishes, you can see that there are gauge transformations under which these generalized gauge potentials are shifted by the derivative of something else. Now, in Maxwell's electrodynamics, the vector potential couples to the world line of particles. Okay. And if one tries to think about the analog of charged objects for these more general potentials, one finds that the analog of a charged object is what's called a P-brain, a terminology I believe was invented by Paul Townsend. So I have a P plus 1 component vector potential. I have a P-dimensional object which propagates through space-time and therefore sweeps out a P plus 1 dimensional world volume. And there's a natural coupling of such a gauge potential to the P-brain through this equation, dx mu p plus 1. So this is a natural generalization of electrodynamics. In string theory, again, it comes out automatically. In the type 2A and type 2B string theories, you find all of these generalized gauge potentials. The case p odd, odd dimensional objects happening only in the type 2B string theory, the case p even happening only in the type 2A string theory. But what you don't find, and that includes the case of the original Ramond-Ramond vector potential, you don't find in string theory any of the charged objects associated with these generalized gauge fields. Now, that's not too surprising for sufficiently large p. String theory is a theory of strings, okay? So it doesn't have p-dimensional objects in it for p greater than 1, one would have thought. And so there can't be any sources for these potentials with large enough p, and therefore it's quite natural that we don't find any sources, any charged objects for these potentials for even p equals 1 or 0, which are the cases of a particle in a string where you might have thought that there could have been couplings of ordinary strings to such potentials. These kinds of charged couplings don't exist. The only analog, the only kinds of couplings that exist for these potentials are sort of magnetic moment couplings where F mu nu couples to some sort of magnetic moment density on the string world sheet. So a question we could have asked ourselves, should have asked ourselves a long time ago, is are there perhaps outside of the perturbative framework of string theory, are there charged objects for these generalized Ramond-Ramond gauge potentials? Yes, Michael. Yes, okay, right. I didn't want to confuse people by pointing that out. Right. There is another kind of two-form potential, which we usually call B mu nu to distinguish it from these A's, which does couple to the ordinary strings, and is identified as Nivea Schwartz, as opposed to Ramon. Okay, that's two people whose names get double. And that one does couple to the ordinary string, so that sort of explains to you why the ordinary strings don't couple to this second kind of two-form gauge potential. Okay. So as I said, one could have asked a long time ago, were there any non-perturbative states in the theory that coupled to these generalized potentials? Now, at this point, I want to explain to you from the methodological point of view what changed. Why were we suddenly able to say so many new things about string theory? I've sort of outlined to you the position we were in with a little hindsight before the string duality revolution started. And the main tool that enabled us to go further was the supersymmetry algebra and the concept of BPS states that Hiroshi Oguri told us about so nicely last time. So very schematically, the supersymmetry algebra, which exists in various kinds of dimensions, and there are various numbers of supercharges you can have in various numbers of dimensions, has this sort of generic structure. You have two fermionic symmetry charges which anti-commute together to give you the space-time momentum and then generally some other stuff where, in the case where we have theories that only have particles in them, these other things that sit down here are charges which transform as scalars under the Lorentz group and are therefore natural to be carried by point-like objects, like particles. And then more generally, it was realized that in certain supersymmetric quantum field theories, there could be other terms on the right-hand side of this relationship in which there were tensor charges. And those tensor charges were associated precisely with higher dimensional objects, these P-brains that I've been talking about. And you might think that's not very interesting, because if I have a P-brain which is infinite, which is what I need in order for it to have a non-zero charge, then it's got infinite energy, so why are we talking about infinite energy states? But if you think about a theory in which you're going to compactify some of the dimensions, you might imagine that I could then take this higher dimensional object and make a finite energy state by wrapping it around some non-trivial topological thing inside of the compact manifold and make a particle state in lower dimensions. And so in order to understand all of the particle states that are available in the lower dimensions, I have to understand all the P-brain states that are available to the higher dimensional theory. And so these generalized supersymmetry algebras become relevant to finite energy physics. Now, as Hiroshi showed you last time, if one considers representations of this algebra in which some of the supersymmetry generators leave all the states in the representation invariant, then one gets particularly small classes of representations which have mass formulas which are completely determined by the algebra. And the way that that works in a very schematic way is that you imagine there's some linear combination, Q alpha I, epsilon alpha I, of the generators that are going to annihilate all the states in a representation. So you take some state psi and you multiply it by epsilon alpha I, and then you hit it on the left-hand side with this object here, and you get zero because this combination of generators is supposed to annihilate all the states in the representation. And on the right-hand side, what you get is something that looks like the massive Dirac equation annihilating the state, a combination of gamma mu p mu plus a scalar, if I ignore these pieces for the moment. And so you get a formula for the mass. This says gamma mu p mu plus some particular m annihilates the state and tells you what the mass of the state is. So for all of these brain solutions, which preserve some subset of the supersymmetries, you can get exact mass formulas. And it's really that fact, primarily, that enabled us to make a step towards non-perturbative physics in string theory and to discover that string theory is really a piece of something bigger, which we now call M-theory. Because the idea is that if you've got an exact formula for the masses of some things in the theory, even if you might have derived that formula first by considering what happens to those things in perturbation theory and calculating their masses perturbatively, this general philosophy tells you that the perturbative formula that you've calculated is an exact result. And therefore, you can extrapolate it into regions where perturbation theory makes absolutely no sense at all. And in particular, if you imagine solitonic solutions of the classical field equations of these weakly coupled string theories, that is, solutions which, in terms of the fundamental mass unit of string theory, which I'll call M string, there are P brains that have tensions that go like M string to the P plus 1 divided by the square of the string coupling. Well, that's a formula you get for any sort of semi-classical object in ordinary field theories at weak coupling. But if those solutions happen to be BPS states, then this formula is true at strong coupling as well. And so we learn that as I take the coupling to infinity, suddenly some of these new states come down to zero mass or zero tension. In other words, they become lighter, although they were originally very heavy solitonic states, much heavier than the perturbative excitations of the theory. In the strong coupling limit, they become the lightest states in the theory. There's something else that we discovered. We, in this case, means Joe Bolchinski, is that this isn't the only kind of soliton that string theory has in it. I told you that, for example, the type 2A and type 2B string theories are theories of closed strings. But you can imagine thinking about open strings in those theories and taking those open strings and insisting that the ends of the open strings lie on some lower dimensional submanifold of space-time, some p-dimensional manifold of space, and if I propagate in time, a p plus one dimensional submanifold of space-time. This means that certain of the coordinates of the string satisfy Dirichlet boundary conditions on the endpoints. Remember I told you in the type 1 open string theory, which propagates in 10-dimensional space-time, the open string boundary conditions were Neumann. The reason for that, of course, is that we wanted these strings to propagate everywhere in 10-dimensional space-time. If we made them Dirichlet, they would be stuck at a point. So now I'm precisely considering the possibility that the theory has states in which certain open strings are stuck on some p-dimensional submanifold. Well, this sort of object exists in string theory. We can generate a perturbation expansion around it, and we think of it today as a sort of different kind of soliton of string theory, something different from the solitons of ordinary quantum field theory, of which there are some in string theory as well, which can be described precisely by the formalism that I told you about. So one thinks of the theory calculated in this framework with strings having boundary conditions on this p-dimensional subspace as talking about a non-perturbative sector of the theory in which there is some infinite p-dimensional object, or in the case p equals zero, a point-like object, defined precisely by those boundary conditions. So it defines a different sector of the theory. And you can show various things. First of all, that the formula for the tension of these p-brains goes like 1 over g-string rather than 1 over g-string squared. If you understand anything about where the g's come in string theory from topological considerations, this object at lowest order in the perturbation theory is a disk. and therefore has a 1 over g because a sphere has a 1 over g string. But I think a lot of you may not know about the topological expansion, so I won't belabor that point. So that's point number one. Point number two, we can derive from this picture the interactions of these brains with the closed strings, because a little piece of string over here doesn't know that it's tied on to the world volume, and so we can derive from the usual rules of string theory splitting and joining interactions in which a little piece of the open string tied to the D-brain pops off, propagates out into the ambient space-time, and looks like a graviton or a dilaton or some excitation mode of the closed string theory. And in this way, we get a prescription for the interaction of the perturbative modes with the solitons, a prescription which can be shown to be completely consistent in a variety of cases. In particular, it's consistent if I consider odd values of P in the 2B theory and even values of P in the 2A theory. Now, the next remarkable fact about these Dirichlet brains, or D brains, is that they automatically preserve half of the supersymmetries. So why is that? Well, I told you that the 2A and 2B theories have these two kinds of supersymmetry charge that run around in opposite directions on the string. That was for the closed string. Now what happens if I put on a string with certain Dirichlet boundary conditions? Well, those boundary conditions will break some of these supersymmetries because, again, you can't have a purely left-moving wave on a string with open boundary conditions. But they preserve linear combinations of the left-moving and right-moving waves, just as the Neumann boundary conditions did in the open string theory. And so these objects, although they break typically half of the supersymmetry of the original type 2A and type 2B theories, they preserve half of it, and therefore they're BPS objects, and therefore this mass formula, which I've erased unfortunately, in which this is replaced by a 1 over G string, is again an exact formula, and there are limits of the theory now, strong coupling limits, in which these objects become the lightest objects in the theory. Now that leads me to the first example of a non-perturbative string duality, which I'll discuss. Namely, let's consider the type 2A theory, and consider, remember I told you P had to be even, and so let's consider it in 10-dimensional space-time and consider the only finite energy P-brain that there is in 10-dimensional space-time, because there are no closed manifolds to wrap the infinite brains around, namely P equals zero, a point-like D-brain. Well, this is an object that preserves half the supersymmetry of the original type 2A string theory. It's BPS. It has a mass that goes like M string over G string. In the limit G string goes to infinity, it becomes a zero mass particle. Furthermore, if one studies the theory in more detail, one finds that these zero mass particles, because they exist in a supersymmetric theory, they of course have to live in supermultiplets. And the supermultiplet that this zero-mass particle lives in is precisely the supermultiplet one would have gotten by thinking about the Kaluza-Klein reduction of 11-dimensional supergravity, putting 11-dimensional supergravity, that is, on a circle of radius r, compactifying it. When I compactify it, I have various kinds of gravitons and graviton superpartners. Namely, there are those which carry zero momentum around this circle. These are very light in the limit when the radius of the circle gets very small. And those are, as I explained to you before, precisely in one-to-one correspondence with the massless perturbative modes of type 2A string theory. But now there are also supergravitons that carry one unit of momentum around the circle. Those would be massive states. Those have never been seen before in perturbative string theory. But now we know that they're there, and we know that they become very light in a certain limit, and so we can suddenly make a correspondence between the string coupling constant and the radius of this extra circle, namely, according to Kaluza-Klein gravity, if you compactify a massless state on a circle of radius r, the first momentum state has mass precisely 1 over r. Now, if one makes one extra assumption, you can derive the rest of the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein compactified supergravity. Namely, it's a fact that if I take k of these BPS states, or let me call it n of these BPS states, n of these particles, these D0 brains, and sit them down and let them sit statically, then that configuration preserves the same amount of supersymmetry as the single D0 brain sitting by itself. And as a consequence, it's an exactly zero energy configuration no matter where I put these brains. You may say, that's strange. These objects are attracting each other via gravity. How come there's no potential between them? Well, it turns out that there are both attractive and repulsive potentials between them, which arrange themselves in such a way to exactly cancel the static force at all distance scales between these objects. And so I can imagine now setting these things around, and in the classical approximation, the weak coupling approximation where they're very heavy, I can set them all on top of each other and get an object that is sort of made out of n of these D0 brains but sits at a single point. That object will have, by the argument that I've just given you, a mass n over r. And that mass is precisely what I would expect for the mass of the higher momentum modes of compactified supergravity from 11 dimensions. Now, it's very easy to go in and dig out the rest of the quantum numbers, in other words, the spin quantum numbers of these particles, and they precisely correspond to what you get from 11-dimensional supergravity. Let me tell you what the content of 11-dimensional supergravity is. It has two bosonic fields, the metric tensor, which is always there in gravity, and then a third-rank antisymmetric tensor, a mu, one of these antisymmetric tensor gauge fields, and then the superpartners of those, which are the gravitino multiplet. In these are particles whose fields have a vector and a spinner index in 11 dimensions. And if you assume that there are these states with momentum n over r, then the spectrum of the states, including the spin components, comes out exactly in one-to-one correspondence with what you find when compactifying 11-dimensional supergravity. Now, why do I say
Can you explain why when you have n zero brains and you still have the same algebra as one zero brain? Is that obvious?
The algebra is the algebra of the theory.
But half of it I got broken, broken by
the right, and it's
the same half.
It's because it's the same boundary condition you're imposing on the strings. You're imposing Dirichlet boundary conditions on all of the components of all of the string fields, all of the Xi's. And so that boundary condition preserves a particular linear combination of supersymmetries. And if I do the same boundary condition someplace else in space, it preserves the same set of supersymmetries.
So is it conceivable to do something perverse, like the boundary condition?
Well, yes, indeed. If I have P brains of higher dimension, then if I consider P brains that are not parallel to each other, then generically I will break more than half of the supersymmetry, and many of those are not BPS states. Okay, that's one example. Now, why did I say assume that I had states of this momentum. I sort of showed you those states. Well, of course, I haven't really done the quantum mechanics of this situation. I've sort of treated these things like classical objects, which is good in some approximate sense when they're very, very heavy. But even very heavy things obey quantum mechanics. And I really do have to show explicitly that there is a threshold bound state of these objects, an object that really is bound that has precisely the mass of n of them put together. Now, the question of the existence of threshold bound states is a very delicate one in quantum mechanics. Quite remarkably, as I hope I'll be able to tell you towards the end, we are close to having a rigorous theorem on the existence of these threshold bound states in this case. We, I think, actually have it for n equals 2 and have something very close to it for all prime values of n, and everybody thinks the restriction to primes is just a technical one. Okay. Now, there's one other remarkable piece of evidence that this picture is really what's going on. Namely, I told you that type 2A has all of these P-form gauge fields, P plus 1 form gauge fields.
Yes. Exactly zero binding energy, or
yeah.
The energy really goes to zero?
No, it's exactly zero, because the BPS formula tells you that this object made out of n of them has precisely the mass of n of them. That's, of course, what you want for the spectrum of compactified objects, right? The momentum n state should have precisely n times the energy of the momentum one state.
The pressure bound states of quantum mechanics.
Well,
let's just, because there the binding energy goes to zero, only two.
Right. Here it's going to be exactly zero because there are no parameters, because there's a unique supersymmetric Lagrangian that preserves it. Okay. So the next piece of evidence, remember I told you there was this Ramond-Ramond one-form gauge potential, A mu, in the type 2A theory. Well, quite generally, one can show just from this picture of open strings coupling to brains that the Ramond-Ramond, you can calculate the coupling in particular of the Ramond-Ramond gauge particles to these D-brains, and you can show quite explicitly that this, the coupling of this A mu to a zero brain is like that of a charged particle. It couples like A mu dx mu d tau. Now remember when I discussed the classical connection between 11-dimensional supergravity and type 2A string theory, the Ramond-Ramond potential came out as the Kaluza-Klein potential. And it's an old story first taught to us by Kaluza and Klein that if I have electromagnetism coming out by the Kaluza-Klein mechanism from a theory of gravity, then the charge of electromagnetism is precisely the momentum around the compactified circle. And so these are precisely the charged objects that are required to make that picture of the compactification of supergravity to the type 2A string theory a viable one. So the picture that we have today is that there's one theory which has a parameter in it. That parameter, remember, is really the expectation value of a certain field. It's the parameter we call G string. When G string is much less than 1, we get type 2A string theory and we have a perturbation theory. When G string is much greater than 1, then the lightest states in the theory are no longer the type 2A strings. The lightest states in the theory are the 11-dimensional supergravity multiplet. And since the theory was originally consistent for small G string and we had a unitary perturbation expansion of the S matrix, we expect that it is still a good quantum theory in the large G string limit, a good quantum theory which reduces at low energies to 11-dimensional supergravity, which I should not erase. Keep it over here. So this is the duality between type 2A string theory and 11-dimensional supergravity. Yeah?
So you seem to be saying that the zero brains of type 2 theory give you the same set of states as the compactified 11-dimensional supergravity. But what about the other
space to go to zero mass in the type 2B transition. Are they using extra?
There are no other finite energy states in the type 2A string theory that go to zero. The gravitons... No, the gravitons that were already there are just the bottom of this tower. They're the zero momentum modes around the circle. The other string modes, okay, the oscillating string modes, are not stable states. They're only stable in the G-string goes to zero limit. So when we take G-string to infinity, we expect that they probably don't survive typically as microscopic quantum mechanical states in a... with any large lifetime. Now, I'm about to explain to you, however, where the type 2A strings come from in supergravity. Okay. So now that's the next question. Okay, we've sort of seen how one might get type 2A string theory to output 11-dimensional supergravity. Let's try to go the other route. Where are type 2A strings going to come from in 11-dimensional supergravity? Well, there's no place intrinsically in 11-dimensional supergravity that the set of fields that I wrote down for you, that these strings exist. However, given this expression, the mu nu lambda field, it's natural to imagine that there is in the 11-dimensional theory, remember I told you 11-dimensional supergravity by itself can't be the full story of a consistent quantum mechanics. We now believe that it's part of a consistent quantum mechanics. So what other things can be there? Well, the existence of this field suggested a long time ago to many people that this 11-dimensional theory should have in it some kind of membrane-like excitation, which couples to mu nu lambda in the analogous way that a charged particle would couple to a one-form gauge potential, an electromagnetic type gauge potential. And if one has such membrane-like objects, one can show, first of all, that it's consistent to couple them to 11-dimensional supergravity, and in fact that consistent supersymmetric coupling of them to supergravity fields implies the supergravity field equations in the same way that consistent coupling of strings to the background low-energy fields of string theory implies the field equations of the low-energy string excitations. In particular, implies Einstein's equation. So there was a very pretty picture with membranes, and once you have a membrane and a circle, it's very easy to make a string. You take a membrane and you make a cylindrical membrane which is wrapped around the circular dimension in one direction and does whatever it likes in the orthogonal directions. And from the point of view of a low-energy observer, when the circle dimension squeezes down to very small size, two things happen. Number one, he can't see the extent of the membrane. The membrane is wrapped around this small circle, so it looks like a string. Secondly, this membrane, like the strings, is a BPS state. It's a BPS state in 11-dimensional supergravity. So although we don't even have a good computation of this, the membrane is not something that we can find as a classical soliton of 11-dimensional supergravity. We can, by insisting that it be a BPS state, compute its mass when wrapped around a circle.
But you can find a membrane.
You can't find a classical solution.
Sorry?
You can find
a singular one.
No, it's not singular.
Sorry?
Well,
it is singular. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Much better.
We can compute from the BPS formula the membrane's tension. And now, naively, if I took a membrane, it had a finite tension, and I took one and wrapped it around a circle of zero size, then you might expect that as I take that circle to zero size, the resulting tension of the string that comes out will go to zero relative to whatever the original tension scale was. And the BPS formula confirms that expectation in an exact non-perturbative way. And so one finds precisely from a theory of 11-dimensional supergravity coupled to membranes, the expectation that there will be, when I compactify it on a very small circle, a string-like solution that becomes the lightest state in the theory, except, of course, for the zero momentum modes of the graviton themselves, which have exactly zero energy. So this is the way in which the string arises from supergravity, by assuming that there is a membrane in the supergravity theory, or in the whatever theory it is that completes the supergravity to a consistent quantum theory. Then I'd like to remark that just as for ordinary electromagnetism, when I write in four dimensions, the field strength is the curl of a vector potential, I can consider the four-dimensional dual to the field strength, which in four dimensions is a second-rank tensor, and I can consider that object to have a source as well, a magnetic current, which is the magnetic object corresponding to a charged particle. Well, in 11 dimensions, the field strength corresponding to such a potential is a four-form. If I do a duality transformation on a four-form in 11 dimensions, I get a seven-form. And then the source of a seven-form field is a current with six indices on it, which is the current you would expect to be swept out by the world volume of a five-dimensional brain, a five-brain. And this one can be found as a completely smooth classical soliton solution of 11-dimensional supergravity. And so the theory, whatever it is, that exists in this strong coupling limit and has as its low energy behavior 11-dimensional supergravity is expected to have in it both these two-dimensional membranes and five-dimensional M5 brains. Okay.
Now, I vaguely recall, I can't remember the details, that some people used to worry about extrinsic curvature terms in string theory or something.
Yes.
And now when you make a, and then people debate about whether the string is fundamental or so, if you make the string out of the 11-dimensional supergravity here, is it automatic that there's no extrinsic curvature?
No. The description of the string from 11-dimensional supergravity, the detailed description breaks down in a very serious way when one goes to the limit, when I get string theory. This sort of classical picture of a membrane wrapped around a circle is not in detail right at all. Okay. However, the BPS formula derived from it is exact. So the string is an exact consequence of the theory, but I can't extract from the classical 11-dimensional supergravity picture many of its detailed properties, and in particular,
so
I can't ask.
That was just a picture.
That was just a picture, right? But the important thing to remember is that if I calculate a BPS formula using such a naive classical picture, I have an exact result that I can rely on. Okay. Now, the second example I'd like to study, how much more time do I have? It's beginning to look like it.
Yeah.
If I only have, when did I start? Okay. So we should probably do it in two sessions. Let me give you one more example, one of particular pretty examples of these constructions. So we've now got this connection, okay, of the type 2A string theory to 11-dimensional supergravity. And one of the reasons that string theorists always ignored 11-dimensional supergravity was they said, well, but we've got the type 2B string theory, and that's just as good, and you can't get that if you're an 11-dimensional supergravity. Well, the answer is you can get that. You just have to be very clever. So imagine taking 11-dimensional supergravity and compactifying it on a two-dimensional torus instead of a one-dimensional circle. And now Let me ask you, as I shrink the size of that two-dimensional torus to zero, how many dimensions are left? Okay. Well, if you're as clever as John Schwartz and Paul Aspinwall, you'll say 10. Okay. And the way the 10th dimension comes out is the following. Take the theory that I've just described to you. Take the two torus, take one of your membranes, and wrap it in the obvious topologically non-trivial way around the two torus. Then I get a state, which, the story goes on as usual, is a BPS state, and whose mass I can calculate exactly, and whose mass, obviously, goes to zero as I take the area of the two torus to zero. What's more, you can argue for the existence of, again, a set of n threshold bound states of such states whose masses are n times as big and therefore also go to zero in this limit. So what I find is that as I take this 11-dimensional theory, put it on a two torus, and shrink the area of the two torus to zero, I get a new continuum quantum number. I get a continuum of states whose energies go like n times a, where n is any integer and a is shrinking to zero. Well, that formula looks like n times 1 over r, where r is some radius. There are some dimensional constants that you need to supply, but those are supplied by the 11-dimensional Planck length, or the 11-dimensional gravitational constant. And one gets a new continuum of states that looks like the continuum of states on a theory compactified on a circle whose radius is becoming very large. So I get rid of two dimensions, and I get a new dimension back, losing only one in the process. And at the end of the day, I come out with a new 10-dimensional theory. Now, what's left in this theory? Well, let's remember that when we take a two torus and we scale out its area, which is what I'm doing here, I'm going to a limit where the only states that I'm going to consider important are those whose area, whose energy scales to zero when I scale the energy to zero. I get left with a parameter called the complex structure of the torus, which is a complex number represented by a parallelogram in the complex plane, except not all complex numbers are different. There's an SL2Z symmetry where tau goes to m tau plus n over k tau plus l, where these are integers satisfying the conditions for an SL2Z matrix. All taus related by such transformations are equivalent to each other. Now that I've got that structure, I can think about taking my 11-dimensional theory. I've gotten a momentum spectrum by considering membranes completely wrapped on that two torus. But now imagine taking a membrane and wrapping one of its directions around one of the cycles on the two torus. Okay, say this one over here. And letting the other direction in the membrane do whatever it wants in the uncompactified space-time, then that will define, again, a string-like object in the limit that I shrink the area of the two torus to zero. I can't see its structure. Again, it's a BPS state. That string, if I choose the short radius of the torus, as I've done here, the smaller one, the lighter state, turns out to be the fundamental type 2B string. But obviously, I could have done this in lots of other ways. In particular, if I choose the longer cycle of the torus, I get another string, which is related to the type 2B string geometrically in a very simple way. And it turns out to be the Dirichlet 1 string of the type 2B string theory. Remember, I told you the type 2B string theory had, in addition to the fundamental strings in it, it had these D-brain solutions for arbitrary odd values of P, in particular P equals 1. And so here we have a picture in which those two kinds of strings come out. And furthermore, they're related by an SL2Z duality symmetry, which acts on this parameter tau. What's the meaning of the parameter tau in the type 2B string theory? Well, in the limit that I take a very eccentric torus, in other words, one cycle much, much shorter than the other one, one of these two states is much, much lighter than the other one. We know that in ordinary type 2B string theory, if I set the scale of the ordinary fundamental type 2B string to be order 1, then in the weakly coupled type 2B string theory, the D string has a mass of order 1 over G, namely much bigger. So I should associate the mass of the short string with that of the fundamentals, the short cycle with that of the fundamental string, the mass of the long cycle with the mass of the D string, and I therefore get a calculation of the type 2B coupling constant in terms of this parameter tau. And essentially I find that tau is 1 over G string, now the type 2B string coupling, not the type 2A string coupling that we were talking about a moment ago. And then there's tau is a complex number. It's got an imaginary part. No, I want the I here. It has a real part. And that real part is the expectation value of another field in type 2B string theory, the so-called Ramond-Ramond axion field. So the type 2B string theory, it is now predicted from this picture, will have two types of strings, and they will be related by an SL2Z symmetry. And in particular, there's a particular value of this SL2Z transformation, which is just tau goes to minus 1 over tau. If I take A equals 0, that's a S-duality type symmetry that flips the coupling to 1 over the coupling. Well, precisely such a symmetry had been predicted in type 2B string theory, and now we see it has a geometrical origin. Connecting to Hirose's lecture from last time, I should point out that we now have a derivation starting from this fact of the Montan and Olive S-duality symmetry of four-dimensional n equals 4 gauge theory. And so this kind of duality lies at the heart of a lot of the electromagnetic duality that Hirose told us about last time. Now, I've talked... I'm going to stop now, not do my next example. I guess I'll do it in another part of the talk.
Can I ask a general question?
Let me just say one more thing. I've tried to show you the most picturesque and simple versions of the information that we get out of string duality. I don't want to leave you with the impression that this is all we have. These pictures, in general, motivate more detailed calculations, and in quite a few examples we've been able to check these duality conjectures with various sorts of explicit calculation. And even more than that, as these calculations built up and we found more and more examples of this duality, we found that everything fits together in a nice way, and that you can derive the same theory three different ways, starting from three different starting points, and you always end up with the same predictions, no matter where you start from. And so the picture has a lot more support to it than the simple-minded notions that I've showed you today. Now I can try to answer your question.
Yeah, I agree that things fit together very beautifully, and so there's tremendous support for the picture. But one of the things is that you always assume that on a BPS state, you assume half of the supersymmetry survives. That seems crucial. Now, is that an assumption, or is it proven, or Because how do you know supersymmetry is not broken dynamically?
Well, for sufficiently extended supersymmetry, there you can show quite rigorously that there's no spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry.
So you can show
that. You can show that. That's just, it's a trivial consequence. There are no fields that could get expectation values. That if you have enough supersymmetry, all the fields are vector fields. Or tensor fields, or gravitation. There are no scalars to get symmetry breaking expectation.
Why are there no
scalars?
Well,
in big enough multiplets, okay. And then I'm saying it incorrectly because if I then compactify that theory, preserving the number of supersymmetries, I get scalars. But the fact that those scalars are connected to vectors by supersymmetry shows that they can't get supersymmetry breaking expectations.
So in the original supersymmetric multiplet, there are no scalars. I'm so surprised because usually these multiples are huge, right? Thousands of
times. Right.
But there's no scalar.
Yeah. Or sometimes there's one, the dilaton. But it's really the fact that the scalars are connected to the vector fields by supersymmetry transformations that guarantee that there can't be anything like a supersymmetry violating superpotential that gets an expectation value. Okay, it's only when you get down to n equals 1, d equals 4 supersymmetry that possibility is.
So in fact, if you turn around, that BPS is the only thing that could break the supersymmetry down.
Well, this is not breaking the supersymmetry. It's, of course, in any theory, each state doesn't preserve all of the symmetries of the theory. So particular states break us.
I thought those were simple questions.
Well, maybe a question. I thought one of the motivations for string theory in the first place was to have a finite theory in the ultraviolet.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see that it's at least a weak coupling limit or perhaps a low energy limit of some other theory.
Well, it's a weak coupling limit. It's not a low energy limit. Indeed. Yes. Well, one doesn't for sure, since we discovered these shorter scales in string theory. In what happens, though, you see these supersymmetric theories with lots of supersymmetry have moduli spaces. They have spaces of expectation values of fields which don't break supersymmetry and they're completely degenerate. And all of the parameters in this theory, like the string coupling constant, are in fact parts of these moduli spaces. So now what are the different scales that come into the theory? Well, you can always relate them to pick one particular scale, treat it as if it were fundamental, and all of the others are various powers of these moduli times that other scale. Okay, so for example, in this situation, we originally had a theory, 11-dimensional supergravity, which only has one scale, the Newton constant in 11 dimensions. That also determines the tension of this membrane. But now when I compactify it on a small torus, if I take the torus to be very small, that defines a new scale, which is smaller than lower in energy than the original one. And so I take that now as my fundamental scale, measure everything with respect to that. So there's really only one fundamental scale in this theory, plus these various continuous modulations of the theory that we know how to do when there's enough supersymmetry. So it's in extreme regions of the moduli space, like the weak coupling limit, in which multiple scales come out. In particularly, weakly coupled string theory always has multiple scales in it associated with these D-brain states. I can tell you that we have a good argument that the full non-perturbative theory is ultraviolet finite, because the real argument for ultraviolet finiteness is based on string perturbation theory, and that's only true in a limit of these moduli spaces. We have ideas about why, in general, these new scales that pop up at weak coupling don't lead to further ultraviolet divergences. It would take a little too long and it'd get too technical for me to explain those ideas to you here. But there are some reasons to believe that they don't lead to new ultraviolet divergences. Yeah?
Historical question. How much, if any,
was sort of understood or guessed at from looking at, you know, just the extremal black pea range? I mean, was it known, for instance, that you could have a Nouveau Schwartz charged string and being on two black pea grains?
In that kind of detail, I don't remember the history. A lot, although I haven't emphasized in this talk, a lot of these results were first derived rather than in the Dirichlet brain framework, in the framework of classical solutions, extremal black brains of various kinds. And you've asked too detailed a question for me to know the answer. Paul or Gary probably have a better.
Well, there is the old idea that these open strings stuck on the deep brain are just the closed strings which are sort of passing through the horizon. And so, you know, from the exterior region, you only see half the string, and so it looks like an open string. So that's what's the connection between the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should all absorb this. And maybe what we'll do is it's a pity to forget all this by 2 weeks. Does that Tom continue next week? Can you go in 2 weeks?
No, I can't go in 2 weeks.
Oh, you can't go in 2 weeks. So Tom will continue in 2 weeks then. And we'll surely summarize everything before he goes on.
In the first hour of my second talk.